Well, good morning. This is Per Fagring, and once again, this is episode 55 of Fight the Empire. And 2 weeks ago, we had an extended program, a call-in show with economist Richard Wolff, all about the impending debt ceiling deal. And so now he is back again to kind of see what we got. Richard Wolff is a professor of economics at University of Massachusetts in Amherst, also a visiting professor in international affairs at the New School University in New York, and the author of When Capitalism Hits the Fan. So, Richard Wolff, welcome back to KBOO.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Well, this is a topic everybody's talking about. Well, 2 weeks ago, we went into sort of the background of this thing. What do you see coming down the road now that they've passed something?
Well, for me, to be blunt and honest, what I think we've just witnessed is a piece of theater that doesn't change much, but that makes you stop when good theater is available and makes you think about your life, and that's how I feel about this. Let me review very quickly. A deal was struck between the president and the Republican Party, basically. That deal does very little about the deficits and the debt of the United States, that is the amount of money that they agreed on, still leaves us this year and next year with a deficit in excess of $1 trillion, which by all historical standards is very bad in terms of the broken budget of the federal government. That definitely means our national debt will rise by that amount, and that definitely means the Congress will be presented by Mr. Obama before his next year is gone with the need to raise the debt ceiling yet again, allowing us to have another rendition of this theater. Second thing I would say is that the theater is a tragedy. Why? Because we have an economic system in our country that is not working for the majority of people, high unemployment, millions of people being thrown out of their home, people who have jobs facing reductions in the benefits that they have, in the job security they can expect, people's prospects for their children looking like not only are they not going to get the American dream, they're not even going to be able to reproduce the standard of living of their parents. Faced with these serious economic problems, we had two political parties that run this country, Republicans and Democrats, debating only how much cutting of the government's spending is going to happen. Republicans want a lot. The Democrats want less. But both of them agree that what we ought to do in this situation is make the single largest buyer in the United States economy, that's the federal government, reduce its spending. As if everyone didn't know that if the federal government reduces its spending, it means the economy will be dealt a blow at a time when it is already in very poor shape. As an economist, that's craziness. But as a political and a citizen of this country, it is a tragedy. What has effectively happened is that a government budget that was broken for three reasons, and I'll mention them, just to make it clear that what the causes of this problem were are not being addressed by the solution. The three causes were the following. 10 years ago, a newly elected Bush government radically cut taxes on rich people and corporations. That deprived the federal government of trillions of dollars over the last 10 years in income. At the same time, Bush, and then Obama as well, undertook extraordinarily expensive global warfare. Iraq, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Libya. That is an enormous expenditure of money to play the role of global policeman, at the same time that you're reducing the revenues of the government by cutting taxes on the rich and the corporations. Then, to make those matters worse, in 2007, basically, our economic system crashed, and Republicans and Democrats fell all over themselves to pour trillions more dollars into the hands of banks, insurance companies, large corporations like General Motors and so on, to try desperately to bail them out first in the hopes that that would somehow trickle down and allow the rest of the economy to percolate. Well, if you cut the revenues of the government 10 years ago, and then you explode your expenditures on war and on bailing out a defunct capitalist system, you can hardly be surprised if in the year 2011 the government budget is busted. The tragedy of these theatrics is only that nothing was done about the corporate tax holiday and the tax holiday on the rich. Nothing was done about the wars. And nothing was done to demand that the beneficiaries of bailing out banks, insurance companies, and large corporations pay something for the bailout that they got. Instead, Republicans and Democrats are debating how much money to take away from retired old people's Social Security, from retired old people's Medicare coverage, from poor people's Medicaid coverage, from student Pell Grant loans for going to college, and thousands of other things our people actually need. It's like the mass of the people are being made to pay the bill caused by the activities of large corporations, wealthy people, in bending the government to their will. It is an amazing thing to watch. It will damage the economy. It will do nothing for the budget imbalance of the federal government, and it will hurt a large number of people. The only real beneficiary is the large corporation and the wealthiest 5% of Americans, who probably are laughing all the way to the bank. But I suspect that the divisions and the damage done to this country will come back to haunt them, and they will be sorry that they have engaged in murdering the goose that lays the golden eggs they collect.
Well, you know, speaking of theater, you know, I think it was Chekhov who said if you have a gun in Act One, it's going to go off in Act Two or Three. And so how do you see this coming back to haunt the perpetrators?
Well, I think that Americans would like to believe, and this is a generous spirit, they'd like to believe that congressmen and congresswomen somehow are as decent as their words convey, and of course some of them are, and that they are looking out to solve the problem. So they give them a lot of benefit of the doubts that they have every right to have, but it's not going to work this time. The mass of the American people are being hurt. The federal government is going to have less money to help cities and states, which means that the cutting already underway in cities and states is only going to get worse. What they've now agreed to do involves what's called cutting the discretionary parts of the budget. That will be all kinds of programs, from unemployment insurance to Pell Grants for students who need the money to go to college. All of that is going to become harder and more difficult. Americans are going to feel that in a countless number of little ways, perhaps not understanding that the trail goes back to this decision to deal with the problems of the economy by whacking the mass of the people. And our economic indicators, by the way, are already clear, turning down. Our housing market in the United States is already in what we call a double-dip downturn. The latest statistics of manufacturing, it's very grim. I really must say that we are heading into a storm of economic tensions at a time when the United States, the gap between rich and poor, is bigger than it's been in nearly a century. All the ingredients for a social explosion. And I think that it is naive as well as dangerous to simply imagine that the vast mass of the American people, who have been led for at least a century or more to believe that they live in a charmed society in which if you work hard, you do well, you move forward, how are they going to understand that they can work till they're blue in the face? By the way, Americans do more hours of paid labor per year than any other working class in the industrial world already. So working hard is not solving your problem. living properly is not solving your problem. You're caught in an economic system that doesn't work. And the cost of that will become very intimately clear and personal to the American people. And given their expectations of that American dream, as the gap between the dream and the reality gets worse and worse, I think they will be looking for answers. They will be looking for who to blame. The search for scapegoats, which is unfortunately also part of our history, will ratchet up. We will get angry at, I don't know, immigrants or somebody to unload our fury. But it will eventually turn in on ourselves. And, you know, the notion that it can't happen in the United States was always wrong. And I am, frankly, to conclude, I am most amazed that there aren't more voices among the corporate leaders of America and the rich, if not out of a sense of decency, well, then out of a sense of self-preservation. They are pushing the situation too far. And to hold on to their wealth, they are taking chances with the fundamental engine of that wealth, which is the working class of this country. Today's New York Times has a front-page story in which a lovely young blonde woman is shown having just tried on at a very ritzy local department store here called Bergdorf Goodman a $2,000 pair of shoes. And the article goes on to gush about how upper-income Americans are spending more than ever on luxury goods. That kind of gap between that front-page story and the ever more difficult conditions for the mass of the people is a recipe for social disintegration.
Well, you know, boy, in today's paper here, we have one article, experts warn of a double-dip recession. I would think that this is just the same old recession. But anyway, we have, you know, the American people are getting so fed up. Like, I think the approval rating for Congress is down to like 19%. But the question is, how does it show itself? Because the ruling class will try and channel it their way, you know, with these little Tea Party things or some kind. Well, like you said, they're looking for scapegoats.
So yeah, I just got off another radio program, to tell you the truth, and there was a Tea Party representative, and we were debating a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And I heard him say, and you know, part of me really just feels sadly for such folks, because in a sense, I see and I hear that they too are troubled what's going on, but they just take it in a different direction. Mm-hmm. They imagine the solution. So he said, as so many Tea Parties folks do, well, gee, the solution is to lower the taxes, not raise them, to lower the taxes on rich people and corporations because, you see, he said, this will produce jobs. Well, this is a fantasy. I mean, my professional life for 40 years is to teach economic history, to teach what has happened in the American economy over the last century. There is absolutely no basis for this fantasy notion that if you cut taxes on corporations and the rich, that translates into jobs or economic growth. I mean, just use your head. If you cut the taxes on rich people, that leaves them with more money. What they do with that money, they're free to decide. If corporations have their taxes cut, that leaves them with more money. They can decide to pay that out in even higher bonuses to their top executives. They can use that money to build factories, okay, but not in the United States, maybe in China, because it's cheaper to pay workers there. They can use the money to enhance the shrubbery around their headquarters. I mean, they can do whatever they want. That's why there is no relationship between cutting taxes and creating jobs.
Maybe they can set up gated villages and fortress compounds.
Absolutely.
And private security
homes and all the rest of it. If you really are serious, which the Tea Party people try to be, but they're caught up in these silly notions that are basically designed to get rich people and corporations off the hook for taxes, which is what they were invented for. But if they really wanted to do something about jobs, do the obvious. Tax the rich and the corporations and use the money to hire people. That's what the corporations are not doing with the money that they now have, and they have record amounts of cash on their books. We know that from the statistics of the government. And they're holding that money because it doesn't pay them to invest in the United States. So they're actually lending it to the United States government since they don't have to pay taxes with it. If you want to create jobs, tax them and do what Franklin Roosevelt did in the 1930s. In 1934, he went on the radio and he said to the American people, if the private sector of the United States either cannot or will not give jobs to the millions of Americans who need and want them, then the federal government has to do it. And between 1934 and 1941, Roosevelt's government created and filled 11 million jobs in the United States. And guess what? He taxed corporations and rich people at very high rates to get that money and to do that, and not just borrowing it, although he did some of that too. He didn't solve the problem that way, but he made a major improvement in the lives of the American people. And a little footnote, he thereby became the most popular and beloved president in the history of the United States. He was reelected four times. He was so successful that we passed a law prohibiting anybody to run more than twice, to be president more than twice, as a result. And so I'm a little mystified that Mr. Obama, rather than drawing the obvious lesson that he, too, could become a really popular president if he actually did something about the unemployment problem, he can't. He is so much entrapped by the same basic ideas that motivate the Tea Party, namely the belief that the private sector is the one that can, that must, that should, that will. But the truth is, it hasn't created jobs. Since Obama became president, he said 100 times, I'm going to provide the incentives and the support for the private sector to deal with the job problem. Well, we have the results. They didn't do it.
Well,
and if the government doesn't do it, it isn't going to get done, and our economy is going to continue to decline.
Well, maybe the private sector has already got Obama a job lined up for after his first term.
Well, they may need to find one for him because, granted that the Republicans cannot seem to come up with a reasonable candidate and tend to have an awful lot of candidates who strike most people as unreasonable, nonetheless, if the economy continues to deteriorate, then people are going to be angrier and angrier. And here in the United States, we have this peculiar ideology that when things go bad in the economy, you don't blame the corporation that fired you and made you unemployed. And you don't blame the bank that went to court and threw you out of your home. You blame the government. You leap over the private sector to find the evildoer always in the government. But Mr. Obama is the head of the government. So if people get angrier and more desperate, it can turn against him in terms of a political result. And I'm even amazed that that doesn't work in some sense to shake up this tendency to believe that the private sector is some kind of guarantor of economic well-being when the evidence is so heavy against that.
You know, one thing Obama can do is let the Bush tax cuts expire next year. Do you think he will do that?
Well, it doesn't look like it, given that he didn't do it last December, mm-hmm. and that he's in showing us more and more of the I need to compromise rather than push kind of attitude. I mean, that can always change. But I have to say, in all honesty, as an economist, to let the Bush tax cuts expire, look what that's going to do. For example, on the level of the private of individuals, it's going to raise the top tax bracket from the current 35% to the lofty 39%. Now, while that's nice, that's a good idea, that's really only the tip of the iceberg. Let's remember that in the 1950s and 60s, the top income tax bracket in the United States was 91%.
Mm-hmm.
That was the result of, by the way, that's history is very interesting. That was pushed by Franklin Roosevelt. And by the way, he used an interesting analogy. He said in the 1930s and 40s, I believe that no American should earn more than $25,000 a year. even if you adjust that for the change in prices since then, that'd be about $350,000 today. Imagine a president with the standing, with the nerve, with the courage to say to all the millionaires and billionaires in the United States, you can't earn more than $350,000 a year. By the way, Roosevelt's justification, simple. He said, you know, I draft people into the American Army in those days, and we pay them $600 a year. It is unconscionable and immoral to ask one American to risk his life for $600 a year while other Americans who are not risking their lives are collecting $25,000. So I think that's a reasonable cap. That freaked out the rich people in America and the conservatives, and they went to town and they fought it and they denounced the president. And here was the compromise deal they reached. The president said, okay, no cap on income, but I'm going to tax your top income at 91%. And the conservatives and the businesses went for that deal. So when I hear about, ooh, we just had a deal between Republicans and Democrats, Roosevelt gives us an idea of what a deal that the mass of people could feel good about was. It gave a high income tax rate for the richest people so that they made a fair contribution based on their wealth to the needs of a society that was coming out of a Great Depression and was facing a war. We're now in a great crisis of America again, but we lack the leadership that has anything like the courage of an earlier Democratic president who had the courage in that time to push for the kinds of resolutions. And, of course, it's not really only about Mr. Roosevelt. The reason Roosevelt did that is he had pressure from below. We had an explodingly growing trade union movement, the CIO, and we had strong socialist and communist parties who pushed in those directions and who mobilized lots of people. Those things are all absent from the United States today, and that's probably the major reason why Mr. Obama cannot repeat the historical experience of Mr. Roosevelt, even though I think both the American economy and Obama's future as a politician would argue the other way, that he does go in the direction that Roosevelt pioneered.
Well, you know, to get a deal like that, you have to start out with a maximum demand, but Obama seems to be starting out with a minimum demand.
Yes, it shows you what he thinks he can get. And I'm afraid it also shows that the Democratic Party has gone in the direction of the Republican Party, becoming more and more dependent for money to run its campaigns, the way politics now works, and therefore having to turn to corporations and wealthy people to provide them with the money, and becoming therefore fearful to say anything that offends those groups, to keep the taxing of them off the table, even this while we savage everybody else in this society. It's a very, very dangerous situation, and I really mean, in the bottom of my heart, dangerous for all of us. This is an economic system that's tottering and now has the addition of a dysfunctional politics that's going to make the tottering worse.
Well, you know, I remember reading some historians, you know, talking about, you know, sort of the collapse of the Roman Empire, and one thing they said was that the system was, you know, it was slowly collapsing, but the people responsible for it had such a stranglehold on the political system that there was no way to prevent it. And it looks to me like we have the same thing happening here, that the people responsible cannot be stopped. And so it just kind of plays out its course like a slow-motion train wreck.
Exactly. And more and more people are aware, as this train heads towards the stone wall, that that's what we have, a train, and it's moving, and there's a stone wall that it's not going to get through. But the folks at the top are so beholden to the status quo, to keeping things as they are, to riding the gravy train until it's over, that we're condemned to be in this position of watching. However, there are ways and there are directions that we can take to change this, but we have to be willing to rebuild or to build new organizations of the sort that made Roosevelt do the things that needed to be done. We have to rebuild a labor movement if we don't have one. We have to rebuild political parties that have the courage to say and agitate in the direction for very different kinds of change. Otherwise, people like you and me and those who understand what's going on will be reduced to shaking our heads in disbelief and in fear of what's coming down the road. There is no alternative to organization. The reason the Europeans are not suffering the way we are, and they have plenty of problems there, is because they have strong trade unions, strong socialist, communist, anti-capitalist parties who basically say to the powers that be there, you can fix your broken economy, but not on our backs. And the consequence is that they are not even contemplating doing half the things we're already doing here.
Well, some of these parties that are doing the austerity game over in Europe are socialist parties like Greece and Portugal. I would put forth as a shining example the voters of Iceland.
Absolutely, and it's tragic that the socialist parties are doing that. And by the way, it's a part of the same process. I think it's socialist parties are in the process. They're basically committing suicide. They're splitting themselves down the middle, betraying in the minds of many of their followers what they supposedly were standing for, as they, too, knuckle under, having believed there is no alternative but to do what's best for the rich and the corporations. And I think you're going to see a radical reorganization, realignment of political forces in Europe. You can already see that. But they start from a much stronger base. The last 50 years have not seen the destruction, the atrophy, the death of their trade union movement, their socialist activities and movements, their communist and movements critical of capitalism. They've kept open the debate that any healthy and sane society ought to have, which is to be able to say, is the economic system we have working, or can we do better? We should have been debating for 50 years. Does capitalism work adequately for us? And certainly in the last decade, we ought to have had an intense debate since the system is working so poorly for so many of us.
Well, that's what we're trying to do here at KBOO. I want to thank you very much for coming back on this show. We've been talking with Richard Wolff, author of When Capitalism Hits the Fan, to continue the discussion on this debt ceiling deal that Obama has reached with the conservatives. So thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Per, and also for your programs in airing these kinds of issues. It's something the American society as a whole needs more than ever.
Okay, well, we will keep on doing that. Stay tuned for Air Cascadia coming right up.